Welcome to the University of Michigan Press Podcast, a monthly show featuring interviews with University of Michigan Press authors. Ellington Uptown, Duke Ellington, James P. Johnson, and the Birth of Concert Jazz by John Howland explores a little discussed yet truly hybrid American musical tradition, lost between the canons of authentic jazz and classical music. Through a close examination of the music of Duke Ellington and James P. Johnson, Ellington Uptown uncovers compositions that have usually fallen in the cracks between concert music, jazz, and popular music. It also places the concert works of these two iconic figures in context through an investigation both of related compositions by black and white peers and of symphonic jazz, style arrangements from a diverse number of early sound films, Broadway musicals, Harlem nightclub floor shows, and select interwar radio programs. John Howland is assistant professor of music at Rutgers University and the co-founder and current editor-in-chief of the journal Jazz Perspectives. Welcome, John Howland.
Well, thank you very much.
So, what is your book about?
Well, Ellington Uptown examines a number of black jazz and popular music trends that involved trying to turn popular music into a concert music in the late 20s and up through the early 1950s. Across the 20s, these trends were often called symphonic jazz, and that term is somewhat dated to apply to all of this, but it's a term that applies to both concert-style compositions and a more elaborate type of popular song arranging that was very prominent in dance bands and soon migrated to radio and Broadway and early Hollywood films. The book definitely talks about a wide variety of musicians, black and white, who are pursuing these sorts of activities, but I focus specifically on this close-knit circle of Harlem-based musicians from the 1910s up to the 1940s. And the group has this older generation of black musicians who broke New York's entertainment racial barriers in both the dance band business and on Broadway in the first two decades of the century. The middle generation, though, is a bit more known by audiences that might be interested in jazz. A key person in the book is the composer and pianist James P. Johnson, who's famous for being the father of the virtuosic Harlem stride piano tradition. This is a key tradition in early jazz. And he also was seminal in bringing all black productions back to Broadway in the early 20s after they'd gone out of fashion for some time. And Johnson wrote the famous Charleston, which is tied, of course, to the dance that really defines the jazz age in the 20s. The younger generation is probably the best known, and this includes Duke Ellington and Fats Waller, both of whom idolized Johnson. The subsequent concert jazz ambitions of Johnson and Ellington were in many ways an outgrowth of the musical activities and cultural aspirations of the older generation of the 1910s, so the book explores this relationship quite closely. So Ellington's concert jazz compositions, from the 1932 Creole Rhapsody to the concert works of his 1940s Carnegie Hall concert series to his rich 1951 Harlem Suite, represent the apex of this circle's interest in creating concert music from what we now know of as the authentic jazz tradition. Johnson's works are certainly lesser known, but they more directly reflect the older generation's interest in black musical theater as the higher musical tradition. So my book explores how Ellington, Johnson, and their circle sought to create some sort of degree of racial uplift and high culture legitimation through these concert works.
Okay, so what was your inspiration for writing it?
Well, back in the Ellington centennial year of 1999, I was at Stanford University working on my PhD, trying to figure out a dissertation topic. And the department needed someone to teach an undergraduate jazz history course, and they suggested that I develop a new class. Well, I ultimately suggested a class on Ellington. And thanks to a friend who runs the Stanford Summer Jazz Workshop, I also had the opportunity from that, as an extension of that class, to work with the big band leader and drummer Louis Belson, who unfortunately just died, and the conductor Maurice Perez, who's here in New York City. to reconstruct and perform Ellington's 1943 landmark concert work, Black, Brown, and Beige, with Belson's big band and the singer Joe Williams. A couple of years prior to this, the Smithsonian Institution opened this incredible archive of Duke Ellington's manuscripts, which were donated by his son, and I was able to get the full score and original orchestral parts to Black, Brown, and Beige, as well as a number of other works that I was using to teach in this class. As I began to study these scores from the Smithsonian, I started to see a lot of rich connections between Ellington's compositional thinking in these early extended works and the designs of a variety of other 1920s and 1930s symphonic jazz-related concert works, particularly those from the Paul Whiteman circle. I also began to notice important connections to production number arranging traditions on Broadway and Hollywood films, and so areas of my subsequent dissertation and in turn, you know, the more detailed Harlem Entertainment focus of this book grew out of these initial observations and inspirations.
Okay, so, but what is symphonic jazz, and why is it important in the history of American musical culture?
Well, the greatest legacy of this idiom lies in a certain luxury pop aesthetic that still appears today in various guises. In its roots in the interwar years, the Lux Pop big band plus strings idiom comes to represent a very special American entertainment sound that goes across dance bands, interwar radio orchestras, jazzy Broadway and Hollywood musicals of the Depression. Most importantly, it ultimately defines the sound of the what we now call the Great American Songbook, with, you know, Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald's recordings of the 50s being central. And just like those better-known recordings, there's a real emphasis on arranging fairly lengthy, what you'd call in musicals, production number-style arrangements through very glamorous, sophisticated string work, and this juxtaposition of that lush sound with sensual, low-down jazz-style elements. The concert compositions of this trend are certainly, several are very well known. I mean, America's most famous concert work is George Gershwin's 1924 Rhapsody in Blue, which is commissioned and premiered by the dance band leader Paul Whiteman. Following Whiteman's 1920s symphonic jazz model, a whole number of traditions emerge all the way up to pretty much every time you have the Grammys. There's some street-savvy artist that's set in front of a tuxedo-clad string orchestra. After World War II, there's a whole range of these glorified pop efforts that range from Hollywood crime jazz underscoring of the 1940s and 50s, jazz soloists with strings across the 1950s and 1960s, various types of mood music and lounge music, the Great American Songbook I mentioned. But it also extends to things like the sound of Motown or Brill Building or adult pop in the Burt Bacharach mode or Phil Spector mode. Great number of soundtracks like the James Bond scores or Henry Mancini's music for Breakfast at Tiffany's, but all the way up to things like Kanye West and Jay-Z performing over the last several years in front of full string orchestras, or Metallica with the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra. It's something that keeps coming back over and over, though long, you know, the tag of symphonic jazz has long since been lost, but the aesthetic is absolutely informing a lot of this music.
With so many big names, why has a musical genre become such a footnote, as you put it in the book?
Well, the footnote status of symphonic jazz has quite a bit to do with the popular circulation of music genre titles and more importantly, canon formation issues in popular music and jazz in particular, because this music was originally thought to be tied to jazz, and it is. It's a part of a family of jazzy-related musics. It's a loosely used term in the 1920s that applies to, as I said before, these fairly influential big dance bands that follow Paul Whiteman's lead. The height of this trend, and when this term was quite popular, runs roughly 1922 to 1929, And it's during this period that you find Broadway orchestras moving towards a more jazzy sound, and they often employed arrangers that originally came from these symphonic jazz dance bands. Those same arrangers found their way off to radio fairly quickly, based in New York, and then ultimately around 1929 went off to Hollywood, when Hollywood was in the midst of a big boom in the new media of sound film. Now, across the 1920s, all of these activities, which were largely promoted by white musicians, were also routinely called jazz, and people like Whiteman and George Gershwin and other dance plan leaders in this vein are widely identified as top jazz artists of their day. Of course, if you ask any jazz aficionado today, are they jazz, and you'll only get a significant laugh, because roughly around 1930, there's a range of critics writing for very small magazines, and mostly white, who begin to take great offense to the suggestion that this Whiteman-Gershwin circle has any relation to real, authentic jazz, which they identify, quite rightly, as black jazz and music that's guided by black musical aesthetics, black swing, and improvisation. Whiteman, both due to the kind of spectacle-oriented, glorified pop of his music, and his unfortunate last name, becomes the absolute primary target in this new critical campaign. And the newly elevated heroes of jazz include, most importantly, Duke Ellington and Louis Armstrong. And despite this damnation of Whiteman in 1920 symphonic jazz in certain influential critical circles, Whiteman remains this top commercial draw in popular music up through the 1940s. He even is the first musical director for ABC television. And he's a well-respected bandleader among white and black musicians. He has some of the highest salaries for his musicians in all of pop entertainment. And he's promoting both white and black artists in both his performances and in commissioning concert compositions. And Ellington was one person who certainly benefited from this. Ellington was one of a number of people who would regularly praise Whiteman in this respect, and Whiteman was certainly an inspiration for Ellington's own concert works in many respects. But as you move to the 50s and jazz becomes an art form in the minds of many Americans, this 1920s sound is largely seen to be well outside of jazz. And there's still certainly many problems with critics about Ellington's own concert works. Are they jazz if they're fully written out? Are they not jazz? But the thing with Ellington's concert works is that they are largely written from within the jazz idiom that he helped to define as a big band composer and arranger. At the same time, we have the rise of this great American songbook sound through Nelson Riddle's arrangements for Frank Sinatra. This reinvention of the swing idiom is a new kind of glorious jazz pop. Indeed, Sinatra's 1950s Capitol Orchestra included a number of ex-Whiteman musicians. Also, Whiteman's model for taking jazz into the concert hall via these concert-style compositions continues to be important as pre-bebop authentic jazz tries to define itself as an art form rather than just a commercial dance music. And there are a wide range of jazz big bands, white and black, that presented Whiteman-style concerts at classical venues such as Carnegie Hall from the 1930s to the 1950s. And almost all of these involve extended jazz compositions. Even Dizzy Gillespie, the father of bebop, one of the fathers of bebop, has his own concert in 1946 in this exact same mold. But this music is now seen as concert jazz rather than the more antiquated model of 1920s symphonic jazz.
So what did Duke Ellington contribute to the genre? How did he change symphonic jazz?
Well, as Ellington begins to work with the idea of extended compositions. Around 1932, he produces this work called Creole Rhapsody. And oddly enough, according to Ellington's son, the idea was from Irving Mills, Ellington's manager, that he was supposed to compete with the for the Whiteman audience, and he had suggested that Ellington write a Negro rhapsody of his own. And Ellington's story is that he went away one night and wrote all of Creole Rhapsody, and that particular work and the works that follow across the 1930s. For some time, follow this formal model that comes out of Whiteman-style concert jazz, and it focuses on how to dress up various popular song arranging traditions in a manner that resembles classical concert compositions. Whereas a normal pop song usually has a verse and a chorus, this usually involves what we call three strains, and it stretches essentially a minute and a half worth of music out to an elaborate arrangement of 4 or 5 minutes. Now, in nearly every case that Ellington begins to explore longer and longer works, he transcends this model and stamps these efforts with a huge amount of original thought and ingenuity that you don't find coming from the Whiteman campus. They continue to produce these sorts of concert jazz compositions for radio or for their own Carnegie Hall concert series. The real turning point, though, happens at around the 1940s, when Ellington has his own concert series at Carnegie Hall each year. And he, beginning with his 1943 Black, Brown, and Beige, he begins to build his compositions from music arranging conventions that come directly out of big band jazz, and these elements include the primacy of the blues, African-American musical aesthetics such as slurs, blue notes, melismas, call-and-response patterns, riff-based textures, swing, and so forth, a greater element of improvisation. He largely abandons the hyper-rhapsodic sounds of 19th-century classical music that saturate the beginnings and interludes of Whiteman-style concert jazz. Now, as seen in the 1943 Black, Brown, and Beige, Ellington's post-war concert works begin to routinely reference a wealth of pre-jazz African-American musical traditions that form the bedrock of Ellington's own musical language and American popular music in general. These include ragtime, 19th-century brass band music, southern dance tunes, gospel and spiritual traditions, and rural and urban blues. And it's this latter model that particularly grows through his exploration of suites, that a truly Ellingtonian style of extended concert jazz takes root, and we find it being a huge inspiration for a number of major jazz composers, from Charles Mingus to Wynton Marsalis.
What do you hope people take away from reading your book?
I think the heart of the book and the key takeaway point that I hope the book carries is that popular music can be artful, and many times artists do intend it to be artful, if not art. And that American popular music traditions are regularly in dialogue with a whole range of cultural issues and other musical trends that extend well beyond a given popular music genre or even a specific generation or era. Musicians regularly live and listen well beyond the pigeonhole boundaries of their musical careers and their outward identities of race and class. A recognition of the, you know, cultural complexity of these influences can only enrich our appreciation of these creative acts and our understandings of the artists themselves.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We've been speaking with John Howland, author of Ellington Uptown, Duke Ellington, James P. Johnson, and the Birth of Concert Jazz. To learn more about our books, please visit us on the web at press.umich.edu. This podcast has been brought to you by the University of Michigan Press. Copyright 2008. All rights reserved.